Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. The 19th Annual International Ocean Film Festival is returning to in-person screenings in San Francisco this year after 2 years of being virtual. The festival runs from April 7th through the 10th. Films will also be available to watch online from April 11th to the 24th. Tickets are available right now. You can find information at yourcallradio.org. Tickets for online viewing will go on sale on April 11th. This year, over 50 films from countries around the world will showcase the beauty and power of our oceans. Joining us to talk about this year's festival are four guests. Ana Blanco is the executive director of the International Ocean Film Festival. Hi, Ana. Thanks so much for joining us again. And we're so happy that you're finally back in person.
Thank you so much, Rose. It's so exciting to be here on the call with you today with our guest filmmakers, and we are so excited to be back in person.
Well, huge thanks to you and your team for putting another amazing festival together. We've only watched the three films that we are featuring today, but they are absolutely amazing, so thank you so much. We're also joined today by Martin Van Ruverwaa, is a documentary filmmaker, cameraman, editor, and director of In Too Deep, The True Cost of Deep Sea Mining. The race to mine the deep sea is posing a serious threat to the last near pristine habitats on the planet. The clock is ticking to stop the largest industrial activity the ocean has ever faced. In Too Deep will be shown this Thursday at 7 p.m. at the Cal Theater, Fort Mason Center for Arts and Culture in San Francisco, and Martin Van Ruverwaa will take place in the Q&A after the program. Hi, Martin. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for such an important film.
Hi, good morning, and thank you for taking such great care of pronouncing my name, which is posing you for various obstacles, but you've done a great job.
I'm so glad. I was afraid I didn't, but thank you so much. It's great to have you on. We're also joined today by Howard Hall, a world-renowned zoologist, marine photographer, and co-director of Soul of the Ocean, a documentary that explores the complexity of ocean ecosystems as communities of independent species and highlights the critical role biodiversity plays in maintaining healthy ocean ecosystems. Soul of the Ocean will be shown this Saturday, April 9th, at 7 p.m. at the Cal Theater at the Fort Mason Center in San Francisco, and Howard Hall will also be part of a Q&A after the program. Hi, Howard, and again, huge thanks for such a gorgeous, beautiful film. Howard, are you with us? All right, I think we can hear Howard typing there.
I'm sorry, I hit the video button instead of the mute button.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for the kind words about the film, and we're very happy to be here.
Oh, we were just in awe, really. Thank you so much. We're also joined by Cheryl Dean, a filmmaker and co-director of The Witness is a Whale, which reveals the secret and illegal slaughter of hundreds of thousands of whales by the Soviet Union and Japan. It also recounts the post-whaling recovery and highlights whales' complexities and importance to the health of our oceans. The Witness is a Whale will screen this Thursday at 4 p.m., at the Cal Theater, and Cheryl Dean will also take part in a Q&A after the program. Hi, Cheryl. Again, another huge thanks, because this was another beautiful film and just really important information. So thank you so much for joining us.
So happy to be able to participate.
Well, first, Ana, I want to start off with you. After 2 years of being virtual, what is it like to be back in person, getting ready to be back in person?
You know, Rose, it's just so exciting. I can't even begin to tell you. You know, we had, it was a challenging 2 years, 20 and 21. We did both of our film festivals online virtually. And then we also hosted four online virtual programs for students, for middle school and high school students across the country. And that was really successful. So, you know, we also had a global audience award program. And so we were able to maintain our presence in the film festival world. And for that, we're so happy and so excited. But to be able to come back in person, we are overwhelmed with the support of our sponsors, the support of our audiences, and of course, our volunteers who help make the whole thing possible. So to say we're excited is kind of an understatement if you can't hear it in my voice already. We're just super, super excited.
Well, and we're just so glad that you survived all of this, because we are so lucky to be home to so many festivals, but not all of them survived, sadly.
No, that's correct. And I think that's one reason why we were able to move the festival. Typically, we're in the second weekend of March. Now we're this weekend in April. So we did move out a month, but it's been a tremendous help for us. And that's mainly because a couple of film festivals decided not to continue. And I would like to point out as well that our partner theaters that we've worked with for years, the Roxy Theater in San Francisco and the Smith Raphael, also survived the pandemic, and they'll be hosting films for us as well this weekend. So we're very, very excited to have them on board as well.
Well, I'd like to ask all of the filmmakers what COVID has been like for you and how it has affected your work. Howard, you have been making films for over 30 years. I mean, I just looked at the list of the films, some of your IMAX films on sharks and whales. I've seen a lot of these films, and you do such incredible work. So what has it been like for you during the pandemic?
Well, we live in San Diego, and we're on the water, so it hasn't been that bad. The big thing has been that we haven't been able to travel like we used to, but we have some very good diving off the coast of San Diego, and I've been able to continue diving and filming and working. And I hate to say it, it just really hasn't been that big a problem for us.
Well, and I bet it has been amazing for you to see what is possible in the oceans when it is left alone, which is what happened in many parts of the world under the pandemic.
Well, one of the ironies is that many places, divers are actually preserving the ocean. So places that are difficult to get to, that get regular diving traffic, that had been shut down during COVID, allowed the fishermen to come in and harvest the animals that would normally be major ecotourism attractions.
Oh, wow. Okay, so that's the dark side of what happened under the pandemic.
It's definitely a dark side. It was kind of interesting. A few years ago, there's a group of manta rays that are very popular down in an island called Socorro, Mexico. And it's difficult to get to. It's 300 miles offshore. You have to get there, obviously, by boat. And the Mexican government decided that this was a wonderful area and the manta rays needed to be protected. So for a while, they just said, okay, nobody goes there. You know, they shut down all tourism. They shut down all fishing. Nobody could go. And as soon as the divers were no longer going to the island, the fishermen were able to go in and illegally harvest the manta rays. Mm. So in many ways, I mean, although I really would rather have the ocean all to myself, having divers out there watching what's going on and advocating for the ecosystem is really important.
What are they doing with manta rays?
Well, they cut them up and make them into scallops and other kinds of things that you think you know what you're eating when you go to a seafood restaurant or a seafood market, but about half the time you really don't know what you're eating.
Half the time. Wow.
Pretty close, yeah.
Cheryl, do you have any pandemic stories you'd like to tell us?
Well, I'll echo what Howard said, is that the lack of people who are advocates for the oceans going out to some of these places has definitely had an unexpected deleterious impact on those ecosystems. But I guess for me, unlike Howard and Michelle, who have been amazing, very long careers in producing films, this film that my husband Nick and I put together is our first long form piece. So we actually used 2020 to do the post-production on it. So we had it, that had its own challenges because we were stuck at home and everything was done via Zoom with our editor who was in Bristol. And the time zones don't work because we're also in Southern California. And when we were recording Sir Jonathan Pryce and his narration, he did a fabulous job, but the studio that they rented in London was 10 a.m. their time, so we had a 1 a.m. wake-up call for that session. So we had our own challenges, but we used the 2020 year to actually finish all the post-production. And that was great. We made the most time of that. But in the year since the film has been finished, while it's been in many virtual film festivals, it just somehow doesn't seem real because we haven't been able to go to these and watch our film with a live audience. So we're very much looking forward to this Thursday.
Oh, I bet. Well, yes. And again, it's such an incredible film. What about you, Martin? What has the pandemic been like for you? And do you have any stories you'd like to share?
Yeah, well, I've always said that the camera is sort of your passport to the world. So it's been a little bit frustrating in that sense. But I did manage to escape a few times, I have to say. I shot a film in the Red Sea about the dolphins to see how they were doing in the absence of mass tourism. So that kind of goes back to what Howard was saying. And I went to the Indian Ocean on a scientific expedition with Greenpeace, but that was all done with quarantines here and there. And so we were out there in the middle of the Indian Ocean while the pandemic was raging. So that was perfect in a way. Yeah. But yeah, I think we've all learned as well to deal with filmmaking in a different way and to produce remotely to a much larger extent than we were used to. And actually the film that's showing in the festival in Too Deep was perfect for remote producing because it's about the deep sea and it's happening in the high seas, the international waters. And it's very hard to get there anyway. So we had to make the film out of existing footage. And I had to conduct a lot of the interviews remotely. So it's a different way of working. It's a challenge, but I think we're all getting there. But I do hope that the camera can remain a passport to the world because there's nothing greater, of course, than to see a story with your own eyes and be able to shoot it.
It's so true. And Howard, I mean, to think that the vast majority of the population will never go underwater, that's what makes films like yours, Soul of the Ocean, so amazing, because people are able to take an hour and a half and go on this journey to this gorgeous place that so many people will never visit.
Well, that's true. And that's certainly one of the reasons we do what we do. We want to allow people to see how beautiful the environment is. For the most part, we try to make films that create a sense of value for the animals and the environment rather than make films that are hardcore conservation films. There's lots of different kinds of films that need to be made, and they don't all have to be the same. So we hope that our films make people love the animals, love the environment, and then other people come along and make films that show, like Martin's film about deep sea mining, show how devastating some of the things that we do are to that environment.
Right. Or in the case of your film, Cheryl, The Witness is a Whale, to really educate people about what happened to whales, just to think that hundreds of thousands of whales were slaughtered by the Soviet Union and Japan.
You're right. It was completely astonishing when we learned about this. And the more that we investigated it, we realized, well, first we were shocked to hear about the facts. And then we were equally puzzled that we didn't know about it and that none of our friends who were immersed in the ocean, if you will, were aware of it either. And so, we just felt we had a responsibility to get that story out into the public.
And we'll go deeper into all three of these films. But before we do that, Anna, why don't you tell us about what you're excited about, some of the highlights of this year's festival?
Well, there's so many to reference, Rose. I think, first of all, the fact that all of the three filmmakers on the call today will be with us in person this weekend. It's very exciting to have everyone with us. So many of our loyal audience members will be joining us again. So we've been hearing from a lot of folks who are just so excited for us to be back in person. We have, at last count, over 45 plus visiting filmmakers, producers, cast members in attendance. And so that's, it just adds a lot of value to being able to see a film and being able to ask the filmmaker what it was like and to dive deeper into the subject matter of the film. One of the things I'm really excited about is we have Rick Rosenthal, who did a new series for Planet California. It's slated for PBS, but he's going to be in town and he's going to show us a sneak peek on Sunday. So we're very excited about that. And of course, you know, we always have our panel discussions. And one that we're really focused on this year is about helping the kelp. You know, the kelp along the Northern California coastline has declined drastically over the last couple of years. And so we have a discussion on how to help the kelp, so to speak. And we're very excited about that as well.
Anna, do you know what is the status of kelp right now? Because you just reminded me, we did a show about California losing 90% of kelp forests. But we did that show, the time is just going by, in November of 2019.
Oh my gosh. Well, that's a long time ago. So incidentally, you know, I've been so motivated and inspired by the filmmakers and the films that we've shown over the years at the film festival that I'm now producing and directing
Oh, wow.
a film about the kelp, and was up last weekend in Fort Bragg and Mendocino and interviewing a lot of the folks who are doing restoration efforts to help bring back the kelp. And in pockets in certain areas, we're seeing it come back, but it's nowhere near the levels that it would have been back before, you know, the ocean started to heat up. And so it's pretty much the same, I would say, since 2019, but we are seeing some improvement. And the number of people who are dedicating themselves to help bring back the kelp is what is so impressive, from urchin divers to, you know, organizations such as the Nature Conservancy, Reef Check, and other folks. It's quite interesting, and our research is now taking us down to Southern California as well. So, and along those lines, there's two really good films in the film festival about kelp, and one of them is talking about the kelp situation around the world. And that was very eye-opening to me. So to be able to show films, to be able to talk about kelp around the world, and then to be able to have local experts come in and talk about it at our panel discussion is very, very exciting. So lots to learn and lots of good people to meet who are doing some fantastic work.
Anna, I wonder what has really changed when you and your team view all of these films. When we think about the urgency that we're in right now, just hearing the news about this latest UN climate report and hearing Secretary General Antonio Guterres calling the report a, quote, litany of broken promises and a file of shame, cataloging the empty pledges that put us firmly on track toward an unlivable world. It feels like every 6 months, his language is becoming stronger and stronger, and they're just screaming at this point that something needs to be done. And I just wonder, what have you seen that enter the films, like the urgency of the moment enter the films that you're watching?
You know, we have, Rose, and that's a really good statement. We have seen more conversation about climate change, and I think that's just a reflection of the fact that there's a bigger conversation out in the world about climate change and the urgency and the impact that it's having, not on only on marine ecosystems, but marine wildlife, and how we as humans engage with the ocean. So we are seeing more films, and, you know, the films are intended to help educate us all on what we can do to become better ocean stewards. And they, in effect, do that. You know, Martin's film about deep sea mining is just so eye-opening. And it just talks a lot about what most people may not even know is occurring in the ocean today. So film is the perfect venue, or the perfect vehicle, I should say, for telling these stories. We're seeing more stories about climate change and the urgency to do something. So I strongly encourage everyone to take a look at the program. There's something for everyone. Mm. You know, and there's a lot of films about ocean heroes, people who are making it their mission, their life's mission, to do something to help protect the oceans. And that's very exciting. It's almost a response to what we're hearing in this call to address climate change sooner rather than later.
And as filmmakers, how do you see your role in this moment? Martin, your film, for example, Gosh, this is something that really deserves so much more attention. At a time when we're talking about renewable energy, you know, where are all of these minerals going to come from? And as you, in the film, as we learn, the deep sea is the largest ecosystem on the planet, the deepest point of the planet. And now major companies are learning that there are a lot of minerals in the deep seas. So what are your thoughts about your role at this time?
Yeah, so I should point out that I was actually asked to make this film, to produce this film on behalf of the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition. And that's an alliance of a huge number of NGOs, so lots of organizations that are very worried about this issue. And as you mentioned before, or Anna mentioned before, this is the perfect example of a story that's out of sight, but shouldn't be out of mind. It's incredibly important. And that's also why I was very excited when I was asked to produce the film, and I wanted to produce it in a very documentary fashion, not as a propaganda film. Obviously, it's hard for us to illustrate the opponent's view, so it is coming from a certain agenda for sure. But this is a topic that I noticed many other filmmakers are interested in as well, and this is the first incarnation of the story, kind of that's out there. So it was very exciting to research this. I found out so much about the issue. And I was really shocked, about what I found. And it's also from a dramatic point of view, it works very well that there's now a sort of a clock ticking, because for a long time we've been on the verge of deep sea mining happening, but now that it will actually very likely start happening, or going from an exploratory stage to an exploitation stage in the next 2 years. So it's become a very hot topic in that sense.
So there isn't much time to get the word out on this.
No, that's true. And also what's interesting is that there's very specific niche audiences that actually need to know about this film. Obviously, it's very important for the general public to know more about this, and it would be great for people to show it to everyone they know, because I think the more people know about this, the more it can be done. But the scientists are really speaking out on this, and there's a specific call to action for scientists to join a statement that's out there to really create more noise around this. But what's crucial is also a business statement that's been formed by the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition. And all these businesses are rallying around this statement saying, hey, guess what, deep sea mining industry, we don't need those metals and we don't want to be involved in this kind of destruction of the deep ocean. And that's very important. So the film is also a perfect vehicle. And, my partner on the film, Farah Obaidullah from the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition, she's done a great job in spotting the opportunity for this production, because it's a perfect vehicle to inform people and inform these businesses and scientists and get them on side.
Well, it really is such an important film, In Too Deep, The True Cost of Deep Sea Mining. It'll show this Thursday at 7 p.m. at the Cal Theater in San Francisco. And we're speaking with the filmmaker, Martin von Ruverwaugh. Martin will be taking part in the Q&A after the program. What about you, Howard, as a longtime filmmaker, introducing people to the beauty of the ocean? What are your thoughts about this moment we're in and the role that you're trying to play?
Well, it's a very tough thing when you've been diving as long as I have to see the ocean really in so much trouble. It's in many ways just catastrophic, and things that seemed so common and eternal 30 years ago are now in many places just gone. And so it's tough. I try to stay as positive as I can, I think it's important to get the word out that, you know, the ocean is still a really beautiful place, but it is in decline. And, you know, by telling people what's going on and at the same time showing them what a beautiful place it is, you know, I hope we're making some difference.
Given that you have been diving for such a long time, what are some of the changes that really stand out for you?
Well, certainly, I live in Southern California, so we have seen a decline in kelp forests. That's one of the things that's happening, and you know, it's kind of interesting. It's very difficult for scientists to it's difficult for scientists to be able to say specifically, this is something that's happening for sure, because the environment fluctuates. You know, it goes up and down. And so you have periods of time when the kelp is really, really good, and then a couple of years it's gone, and then it comes back. But each time it comes back, it's less than it was before.
And Cheryl, what are your thoughts about the role that you are trying to play and want to play in this moment?
Well, I guess our film steps back a little bit more, because not everybody has the longevity of Howard and seeing what the oceans were like 30 years ago. Well, our film, we try to make people imagine what oceans were like thousands of years ago, hundreds of years ago, before any of the whaling took place, legal or illegal. And when we were interviewing one of the Russian scientists, former Soviet, he had talked about how they sailed into a bay once. I think it was off the Kamchatka Peninsula. And it was early one morning, and he said they could see a forest of blows. There were so many whales that the spouts that they emitted when they were on the surface, just breathing quiet one morning, all of those spouts, hundreds of them, made it look like a forest. And I don't know any place left on the planet where we can see that today. So putting a longer-term perspective as to, people talk about shifting baselines. And if you look out and you see something that looks nice and healthy, well, that's great. But what was it like before people got involved on such a large scale? So that's one of the messages of our film. For one example, concrete example, blue whales in the Southern Hemisphere were reduced to about 1-2% of their population. Wow. That's the largest animal on this planet, and we almost wiped them out. So they're recovering, but very, very slowly. And putting that into perspective, because there is so much beauty, but we almost lost it. And then I guess the second part of that is there's a lot more science that's coming out now to show the importance of whales in the ecosystem as basically ecosystem engineers, fertilizing the oceans. And they have a huge important role that we're only beginning to appreciate.
Well, if you'd like to see The Witness is a Whale, you can see it this Thursday, April 7th at 4 p.m. at the Cowell Theater in San Francisco. And we're joined by co-director Cheryl Dean, who will be there to take part in a Q&A after the program. Howard Hall is co-director of Soul of the Ocean, and you can see that film this Saturday at 7 p.m. at the Cowell Theater. Howard will also be there to take part in a Q&A after the program. We're also joined today by Anna Blanco, executive director of the International Ocean Film Fest. It begins this Thursday. The films will also be available to watch online if you're not in the area from April 11th to April 24th. Tickets for online viewing go on sale on April 11th, and you can find information at yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls, One Planet. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about the 19th Annual International Ocean Film Festival, which is returning to in-person screenings in San Francisco this year. The festival runs from April 7th through the 10th. You can find ticket information at yourcallradio.org. The films will also be available online from April 11th to the 24th, and tickets for those can be they go on sale on April 11th. Today, we are joined by Anna Blanco, Executive Director of the International Ocean Film Festival. Martin von Ruverwaugh is a documentary filmmaker and director of In Too Deep, The True Cost of Deep Sea Mining. The race to mine the deep sea is posing a serious threat to the last near pristine habitats on the planet, and the clock is ticking to stop deep sea mining. You can see that film Thursday at 7 at the Cowell Theater in San Francisco. We're also joined today by Howard Hall, co-director of Soul of the Ocean, a beautiful documentary that explores the complexity of ocean ecosystems. Soul of the Ocean will be shown on Saturday, April 9th at 7 p.m. at the Cal Theater. Cheryl Dean is co-director of The Witness is a Whale, which reveals the secret and illegal slaughter of hundreds of thousands of whales by the Soviet Union and Japan. It also explores the complexities of whales and the importance of their health on our oceans. The Witness is a Whale will screen this Thursday at 4 p.m. at the Cal Theater, and all three filmmakers will be in person for Q&As after the program. If you have any questions or comments for our guests, we'd love to hear from you. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org, or you can tweet us at Your Call Radio. Howard, the one thing that kept going through my mind seeing so many underwater films is, how did you get this incredible footage? I mean, I had to pause so many times and go back, which I guess I feel really lucky to be able to do that, because you can't do that on the big screen, but the footage was just stunning.
Well, it's animal behavior, and it's just what I like to do. So I spend an incredible amount of time working on a sequence of animal behavior. And a lot of that time is just spent, you know, on my knees on the sand or on the reef, watching an animal do something for often hours. And I think one of my talents is I don't get bored with that. A lot of people just put up with it for a half an hour or so, but I've spent as much as 6.5 hours underwater trying to film one sequence of animal behavior. So it's just something I like to do, and it ends up in my films.
Well, thank you, because as a result, I mean, we just were able to see these amazing creatures. And then there's so many incredible facts. I just want to share a few that I wrote down, and then if you can share some of your favorites. To learn, let's see, well, I loved the cleaning stations. Okay, so first of all, for people who are not familiar with cleaning stations and might not see one in person, can you just tell us what they are and how they operate?
Well, cleaning stations are particular locations in the ocean, in really almost every ocean, where animals go to interact with other species. And that interaction usually involves a smaller shrimp or fish removing parasites and bits of necrotic tissue from larger animals. And it happens all the time. And I think one of the things that became sort of a theme for this film, and it's was sort of an epiphany to me, was that I've spent a lifetime swimming around underwater, and the number of times I've seen natural predation, you know, sharks attacking something, big fish attacking small fish, are surprisingly small, very few times. But cooperation between species, we see all the time. I mean, on every dive, you see animals interacting with other animals in some form of symbiotic behavior. Cleaning behavior is one of those kinds of behaviors. It turns out the ocean is a much more gentle place than a lot of people give it credit for.
I just love that. And then jellyfish cannot see or hear, but they travel together. Many have unique passengers. In one scene, we see a juvenile slender crab holding on until he's big enough to survive alone. Delicate medusa fish live in a fragile mobile home. And then this was the other one. Rockfish can live to be 200 years old.
It is amazing. And if the ocean was such a violent place, you know, how do these animals live so long? There's whales out there that live to be over 250 years, and they just recently discovered that Greenland sharks can live to be 400 years or more. So the longest lived animals on Earth live in the ocean, and it's not a place where they're just constantly fighting to survive. A rockfish can live on a reef for 120 years, even longer. And, you know, it's surprisingly peaceful much of the time.
Well, and as we learn, the undersea world seems to be more intricately balanced than ours. And you can just see that based on the footage that you got of these incredible creatures working together, playing together, or in some cases, courting each other. The giant cuttlefish put on an amazing show to court each other.
Well, on land, you have isolated places. North America is isolated from Europe, and Australia is isolated from just about every place. But the ocean is one big place. It's all connected. And things that happen in Indonesia affect things that happen off the coast of California. It's one big body of water. And the change in one species affects many, many others and can have a worldwide influence. So I think one of the things that's really we try to get across in our film was that the ocean it's like the human body. You can live without your tonsils. If you remove somebody's tonsils, okay, no big deal. You can remove an appendix, and then you can even get to where you can remove a lung and people can survive. The ocean is like that. The species are all interrelated and their interactions are critical to the health of everything. If you remove one species, it affects hundreds of others, but you may not notice it. But if you remove enough species, the ecosystem collapses. And we're beginning to see that in ocean ecosystems all across the planet.
Well, and then also, you do such a beautiful job of showing us these amazing creatures, and then all of a sudden, we see creatures having to deal with plastic or other things that are thrown into the, quote, garbage, which ends up in the ocean, and then also to see animals caught in gill nets, which was really hard to watch, especially the sea lions.
Well, there's certainly a lot of things that are negatively impacting the ocean today, but I think the most dramatic thing is overfishing right now. It's something that we could more easily do something about than global warming. Certainly global warming is going to have a big effect on oceans and already has. But overfishing is having a huge effect because we've taken the vast majority of the big fish have already been removed from the ocean. And things like kelp forests declining, that's a trickle-down effect from removing sea otters and removing other things that feed on sea urchins, which eat kelp. And when the sea urchins proliferate, the kelp forests decline. And also water quality, because sea urchins can survive if the water quality is relatively poor. If there's a lot of ocean waste put in the water, sewage, for example, sea urchins can actually survive on that, and so the kelp can't come back. There's just so many different kinds of influences that are across, many different species that it's difficult to sometimes to quantify it.
Well, I hope you can see this incredible film, Soul of the Ocean. It's screening this Saturday at the Cal Theater in San Francisco. Howard Hall is co-director of The Soul of the Ocean, and Howard will take part in a Q&A after the program. And again, ticket information is at yourcallradio.org. Cheryl Dean is co-director of The Witness is a Whale. And Cheryl, another incredible fact that we learn in your film is that bowhead whales are some of the longest living mammals. They can live up to 260 years old.
Absolutely. Yes. Incredible. And that is determined by scientists examining their DNA. But before that was even done, there have been some spearheads that have been dated that have been in bowheads. And some of them were Aboriginal. Some of them had dates on them. So yes, absolutely. It's they're one of the longer lived species.
And was it 1930 when 90% of bowhead whales were gone?
Yes. A lot of the bowheads had already been taken because they have a smaller range. They're more Arctic specialists, so that you won't find them in tropical waters. You won't find them in the southern hemisphere. And they're one of the largest whales and more slow swimming. And they were easy to target by the early whalers.
And the survivors, those who managed to survive, hid in isolated pockets?
Yes. And that luckily, because there was a lot of ice, they are one of the few whales species that swim and live in areas in the Arctic region that's sometimes covered by ice for about 9 months of the year. So they use their heads to break up some of the ice, possibly as thick as a meter, three feet thick, to breathe. And but they were able to evade the Soviets so that we still have bowheads today.
Wow.
But yes, it was touch and go for a while. So as late as the 1930s, they were still being hunted. You're right.
And some of the information we learn in your film, it almost feels like it's a drama, not a documentary. I mean, we learn that the KGB was involved in this. The KGB, well, one representative for the International Whaling Commission from the Soviet Union was in a KGB assassination unit and was really monitoring members of the International Whaling Commission. Can you tell us more about that?
Absolutely. Yes. We had the great privilege of meeting with Alexei Yablokov several times before he died. And we were actually the last film crew to interview him. He ended up being Boris Yeltsin's science advisor. And back in the 90s, during the period of Glasnost and Perestroika, he decided that this was something there. Deeds of the past, he wanted to come clean because he wanted the world to know the extent of whaling that went on, because we can't really repair the damage that we've done without knowing the full amount that was done. So back in the Soviet times, the KGB ran all of this. They ran 5-year plans which set quotas. And international travel was extremely regulated and monitored. So there were KGB agents on each of the whaling fleets that were out around the world. And yes, we have one of the protagonists talk about his encounter with a KGB agent who used to be in the assassination unit. And he survived, but had to take some precautions.
Wow. What are your thoughts? I mean, in terms of putting this information out there, just talk about why that's important for us to learn about this history.
Well, it's a fascinating history lesson, but it's relevant today because the oceans have not gotten back to where they should be. And, where we need them to be as far as the health of all of the populations there. And I think it also, as Alexei Yablokov says in one of the interviews with him, we were destroying sublime creatures without even understanding them, and using nature and killing wildlife mindlessly. We can do better than that. And hearing these thoughts from people who had been involved, the scientists involved with the whaling community, this isn't Greta Thunberg. This is not somebody you expect to hear that message from. When Yuri Mikhailov went to, you know, as a young scientist back in the 60s, went to the head of the fisheries department in Moscow and complained, saying, "This isn't sustainable. My grandchildren won't have whales if we keep this up." And the head of the fisheries said, "Your grandchildren aren't paying my salaries." I mean, this is something that, even though that happened with whales in the 60s, we can certainly take those messages home today with the overexploitation that we're doing in other fisheries in the ocean.
Right. Well, and if you'd like to see The Witness is a Whale, another incredible film, you can see it this Thursday, April 7th at 4 p.m. at the Cal Theater in San Francisco. Cheryl Dean is co-director of The Witness is a Whale and will take part in the Q&A after the program. Martin, as Cheryl was talking about how we can do better and how some people did not know what they were killing, this just ties in directly into your film, because we do know now. And like you say, we've got 2 years left deep sea mining. What will it take to prevent this? There's a lot of activity going on. I was checking out the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition. And as you said, some companies have come out saying, we're not going to take part in this. States are now passing deep sea mining bans. So let people know, just how can they get involved and to raise awareness about this issue and then also to take action?
Yeah, so that's really the silver lining of this story, that it is a huge looming threat. But at the same time, this is one that we can actually nip in the bud. We can actually literally stop it in its tracks before it really starts to take hold. But like I said, the clock is ticking. So basically, there's three types of audiences here. There's the general public, whose main role is basically to be the megaphone for this story and tell as many other people about this so that there's a momentum around this. Because again, it shouldn't be out of mind, even though it's out of sight. It's all happening very deep down in the ocean and in the high seas. Then there's the scientists who can, you know, get around the scientific statement to oppose this, and the businesses, and also for the Bay Area, that there's a lot of industries there that might be of interest to the deep sea mining industry, and they could really take a stand against the deep sea mining industry and make it a very bold statement and say, look, we don't need this, we don't want these minerals from the deep sea.
It is incredible to think that there are thought to be a million species in the deep sea. And then just watching the footage, I mean, they're just so, I mean, some of them are so cute. Some of them are so odd. I mean, the colors are so vibrant. First off, can you just tell us about some of these creatures that are in your film and how amazing they are?
I mean, the statistics of the deep sea are just mind-boggling. I mean, we were talking about, long-lived animals. I think if there was a contest, then I think the deep sea would win. I mean, we have to understand that this is a very special environment. It's very different from the timescales that we as humans are used to. Life happens literally at a very different pace. Everything happens very slowly. Life is quite dispersed, even though it's hugely diverse. And so that's why you get all these very unique and very odd looking creatures, but they're highly adapted. And that's also why this ecosystem is so sensitive to disturbance. And that's why this industry, even on a small scale, could have quite a big impact also through things like sediment plumes that could easily smother animals. Because even though all these very unique creatures are highly adapted to this ecosystem, if anything were to change there, if anything disturbs them there, then that has a massive impact on them. And many of them are attached to the seafloor, so they can't run away or swim away. Mm-hmm. But so that's something to really, really bear in mind.
That corals live for over 4,000 years and sponges have been alive for more than 10,000 years.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling. And of course, the film was greatly helped, and that was a huge undertaking for the film as well, to go to all these scientific institutes and try to get the best deep sea footage. And even though we've only investigated something like 0.001%, there is now a growing and quite fabulous library of deep sea footage. And it was sometimes really quite hard to choose because the habitats and the species all look so amazing. Mm-hmm. And also, even though it's so far away, there's something very emotive, I think, about the deep sea creatures, maybe because they look so alien and we share the same planet with them. Deep sea imagery is always incredibly popular, I've found, with people. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, again, it's such an important film. And again, it's a short film, about 18 minutes, and so important. Is this Martin film going to be shown in schools? And it should be shown to governments. I mean, just to get the word out. You pack so much information in such a short amount of time.
Yeah, well, I do think certainly for this one, it is very important to get this to policymakers, because the issue is very much on the negotiation table. I do know that just in the past week, there's been a meeting from the International Seabed Authority, which is a UN body that actually regulates deep sea mining. I don't know the specific outcomes of that. I did have a quick look on their website. But I do think that in general, certainly with this issue, but also with the other films in the festival, that schools are a very important place to show these productions. And I think they would be very receptive to these kind of topics as well. And this is, of course, where we have to, you know, sort of shape the minds of leaders of the future. And it's often young people who are the most willing to change their ways or to take action. So I do think young people in schools are a very important audience for these types of films.
In Too Deep, The True Cost of Deep Sea Mining will be shown this Thursday at 7 p.m. at the Cal Theater in San Francisco. Martin Van Ruverwaugh is a filmmaker and director of In Too Deep, and he will be there after the program. Howard Hall is co-director of Soul of the Ocean, and that'll be shown Saturday, 7 p.m. at the Cal Theater in San Francisco. Cheryl Dean is co-director of The Witness is a Whale, and that'll be shown Thursday, April 7th at 4 p.m. at the Cal Theater. All three filmmakers will be taking part in a Q&A after the program. And Anna Blanco is executive director of the incredible International Ocean Film Festival. Again, huge thanks to Anna, the team, and all of the volunteers for putting this festival together. Anna, Martin, Howard, and Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us. And thanks for these incredible films.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Thanks, Rose.
Thanks so much. And huge thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering the show. And you can find information about the International Ocean Film Festival at yourcallradio.org. These films really are so beautiful and so important, so I hope you can take some time to see a few of the films. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.